This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack.
And Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, what you need to know about the Facebook whistleblower accusations.
Plus how to turn photos into real life videos thanks to some new technology.
Also on the show, we tell you where William Shatner is heading in a worldwide first.
And we introduce you to a tool so that the next generation can get involved in politics.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
This episode of The Feed is brought to you by Norton, one of the leading consumer cybersecurity brands. No one can prevent all cybercrime or identity theft, but when you want to help protect your devices, choose Norton 360, available at Staples.
Trending up.
Amber, I'm so jealous of where you are right now, and I'm also looking forward to your cybersecurity tips at the end of the show, because I want to know what your passphrase is, because I think it should be something like, who are you not going to call? Michael B.
Well, first of all, my cybersecurity tip before I get into the real one is that never share your actual password on a radio show. So let's start there. But I'm pretty sure you know that, hopefully. Now, we're going to talk a lot about this on this show. The big news.
Sorry, and where are you right now before we get into it?
Oh, yes.
You are very lucky.
I'm in Prince Edward Island here for Canadian Thanksgiving weekend, taking a few extra days and looking forward to hanging out with my family again. And we've seen them a lot lately, just trying to make up for some lost time. And it's beautiful there, so I cannot complain.
Is that because you couldn't connect? You couldn't connect on Facebook, so you were like, I'll go fly see them?
You're like, I'm out of here. It's a good point. So first, before we talk about the outage, we wanted to talk about the Sunday night 60 Minutes expose that aired, featuring a woman who used to work at Facebook, now known as the Facebook whistleblower. And this was interesting. So she basically had come out to say that Facebook knows that it is doing damage to society in terms of how their algorithms work to spread hate and disinformation and misinformation, but they aren't necessarily willing to act in a significant way because it would mean a loss in terms of revenue. And it was quite the story. And finally, people are taking this more seriously, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. And what I found interesting, because subsequently, since that expose, she's gone in front of a committee and been asked a whole bunch of questions, and everyone's been glued to their screens to hear what she has to say in regards to her testimony. What I found interesting was, I think it was one senator asked whether Facebook is used by authoritarian or terrorist-based leaders. And of course, she said yes. And she gave an example of what we've been seeing in Myanmar and Ethiopia as an example of how the platform can be used to obviously, you know, sow violence. And we obviously usually talk about the riot on Capitol Hill in January in the US, but it's being used around the world. So what I would like to know then is, what do they do as a result of that, and how quickly do they address that and stop and prevent those things from happening? And then finding out what information they know and don't know at certain times. And so I think then that would become very critical to then work out whether they are in fact doing the wrong thing and against public interest and safety and those kinds of things. So finding out that stuff, like getting past the, yeah, we know they make a profit. Yeah, we know they change the algorithms, but it's working out when they know stuff and when they make decisions based on when they know.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to see the impact that they can have. And I think the pandemic has only accelerated the issues that we see in general. More of us are spending more time online. This was the only way we could connect. I mean, you kind of joked with me about the fact that I couldn't connect during the outage, which was absolutely true. My dad runs this group on Facebook here on Prince Edward Island, and it's called Future of Charlottetown. And, you know, that's part of something that he does on a daily basis. Like, it does impact people when these services go down. So let's talk a little bit about that. The outage, I believe, was for about 6 hours, and it was a global outage. Many people went to Twitter to talk about it, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, even the CEO of Facebook put out a tweet. The Facebook tweeted to tell them what was going on. So obviously it impacted Instagram and WhatsApp and other platforms that are owned and under the umbrella of Facebook. In fairness, I didn't actually notice there was an outage on Facebook and Instagram. I only did because I had replied to a message of a friend of mine who contacts me only through WhatsApp. And I think it's just a check to see if I've read their message. And then all I simply did was move to email or another platform. But as you said, there are a lot of people that do rely on it, and it can be a very useful communication tool. I do think that when people were in uproar, it just bothers me that people don't fully understand and comprehend the complexity of technology. And we've gotten so used to on-demand. Its services, like hundreds of thousands, billions, like billions of users around the world. It's not easy. There is bound to have problems happen. And I think that we forget the positive and the marvel of where we are today and what a privileged position we're in to be able to be outraged by 6 hours of being down of something that gives us immediate access and connection to anyone, anywhere in the world. So I don't know. That's my kind of thing on that. And also, just one other point in regards to the whistleblower, I wonder, you know, she clearly, like, what is she going to do now moving forward for employment? Because I can't imagine it's going to be easy to come forward and uncover and tell people what a company's done wrong. But also, you know, people are going to be quite nervous about having her around other. It's quite a remarkable situation.
Yeah, it is. I would just say that, she was very upfront about the reasons that she came forward, right? And she did it in a very, very, very classy way, if I can say that, in the sense that it was all based on documentation she'd gathered and details and her experience. And she raised the flag a number of times while she was working there to try to do something. And they had even dismantled a group that she was part of that was focusing on the future of civic integrity. So we know that she tried to go so far, she couldn't do it. So I actually think more than anything, this will not hurt her. I think this will be something where people respect her. And she's called on other people to come out, which is interesting to see if there are more whistleblowers. I know we don't have much time and we do need to talk about the
last story. It's very courageous. I hats off to it because it's such a difficult position to be in and you just don't know what's going to happen and how it's going to unfold.
Absolutely. Okay. So just quickly, William Shatner is going where no 90-year-old man has gone before.
Yep. That's, I just wanted you to say it.
That's it. So he's going to fly on Blue Origin's next human space flight. Is happening October 12th. And it's a perfect pick, I think, for heading to space. Getting William Shatner is a huge win for Blue Origin.
Well, and I just wonder, because in 90, I wonder if he just kind of sat around and was like, you know what, I've done everything else. Sure, let's give it a go. Because such a marvel and where we've come, but also it's very dangerous. Like, things can go wrong. So I wonder if that factored into his decision-making. He's like, well, I've had a great run. If this is how it goes. I get very nervous every time a shuttle takes off and people go to space. So hopefully it goes really, really well. And it's exciting. So I'm sure we're going to hear more and more about that journey. And then obviously more people going to space. Stay with us. When we return, we are going to tell you how to turn your family photos into videos.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
We've talked about the technology behind the MyHeritage app before on the show that turns family photos into lifelike moving portraits. Well, the company behind this technology is DID, and their CEO and co-founder, Gil Perry, is joining us now to talk more about speaking portraits. Hello, Gil.
Hey, everyone. Great to be here.
So this is really cool technology. Let's explain a little bit more about the MyHeritage app and that the early days of this technology so people can understand how you can turn these family photos into moving portraits, which is super cool.
A little bit about the DID and our technology. So as some of you may know, the company actually started from a privacy angle. We started by protecting against face recognition, and we recently entered into the media and entertainment space with our creative AI platform, which many people, as you mentioned, know us from the project we did with the MyHeritage Deep Nostalgia. They were using our live portrait products, which brings still photos to life. So the way that it works is that companies send us photos, still images, and we use driver videos to bring these photos to life and transform them into videos. And the MyHeritage project went viral. More than 92 million animations were done. It got to be the number one app in the free apps charts. And since then, we did many more projects and recently announced our new product, which is Speaking Portraits.
And so, speaking of speaking portraits, how is that different and how specifically does the technology work?
Cool. So the way that live portraits work is that we have driver videos behind the tech. It's actual actors that are doing these movements and bringing these photos to life. So the still images act the same way as the driver videos act. Now, in Speaking Portraits, our new product, you simply, the user, the company, enters either text or audio in the still image. So no need for a driver video here. You can basically take any type of text or audio, let's say all of Wikipedia, and a still image, let's say, of Albert Einstein or yourself, and you get, as a result, a video of Albert Einstein speaking all of Wikipedia in any language that you want. The way that it works is that we transform the text into audio using a text-to-speech technology, for example, Amazon Polly. And then using our technology, we know how to transform the audio into lips movements, which we then animate into your still image.
So I wanted to ask a question because I was reading a TechCrunch article about what you're doing. And some people may think that, as they mentioned in the article, that speaking portraits is a little like deep fakes. But can you talk about how it is, in fact, different?
Yeah, so people call many types of synthetic media a deep fake. But actually, deep fake is face swapping. So you take someone's face and replace it with the face of an existing video. Here, it's a different technology. You take a still image, an existing image, you don't swap its face with another face, and you just bring it to life and make it speak. So, as I mentioned, we are coming from a privacy background and we are making sure that the technology is being used here for good. And we're putting a lot of guardrails and watermark and things to make sure that no one is confused by what they're seeing and that the technology is being used for good purposes.
And so what are some real-world examples of how you see speaking portraits being used? Because, I mean, this is pretty amazing. I can imagine this would have been far more interesting when I was at school if I could have the actual scientist we're talking about and learning about actually telling me about what they did.
Yeah, so that's a specific use case for the technology. So you can take any learning experiences, museums or galleries or history books. And you can take the photo of the subject, and he will explain to the audience whatever they are reading about or watching. For example, as you saw in TechCrunch, we showed how we take Frida Kahlo and bring her to life, explaining about one of famous arts. The wounded deer, you can see it at TechCrunch Disrupt. So that's one use case for galleries, museums, and the learning material. Another example is for corporate training. So usually corporate training, you have a lot of presentations and text, and now you can, in a click of a button, transform these into videos of people explaining to you about the content. Another use case is a conversational AI kiosk or AI assistant. So imagine any computer that you are now communicating with. Let's say you arrive into the airport and you need to check in. You can now have someone talking to you, calling you by your name, etc., explaining to you about what you need to do. Or chatbots. You are now on a website. We're used to text with these chatbots, but now they can be real. You can have a real person talk to you through the chat. Another example is what we are doing, most of us, almost every day, is video calls. Let's say we were now on a video call, and I could just pick any photo of myself, my better self, maybe when I was younger and look good and fresh, and I can we will just transform my audio into a video of myself speaking. Or if I text you a message on WhatsApp, instead of reading the text, you can see me actually speaking to you. Another example is news anchor. So newscasters, for example, the news aggregator sites, you can take articles and choose any newscaster that you want, and you'll have him speaking the text to you.
Amazing.
Well, hopefully they're picking Amber and I, right, Amber?
I was just thinking of that. It is very cool technology, and I'm sure there's going to be some incredible use case scenarios in the months to come. I just wanted to thank you for taking the time and joining us today to talk more about speaking portraits. Really appreciate you being on the feed.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, an easy way to live a better plant life.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Aptastic.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. It's time now to take a look at some new and trending apps. First up, we have the Plant Life app. This is an app to basically help you learn more about growing houseplants, taking care of your yard and your garden, even plant-based diets and wellness. A very cool community that focuses on plants. Plants versus people, Michael. This sounds like a community for you.
Plant. 100%. And the reason why I stumbled upon this was every time I speak to my parents now, they've moved into a retirement community, and my dad has transformed the front and back garden that they have in their new little house. And it's absolutely spectacular. And he's growing all kinds of vegetables and fruits and the most beautiful sunflowers. And I didn't understand just how much work goes into perfecting that. And they're cultivating from their own garden and cooking, and they're super happy. And I had all these questions. And he said, well, you know, there's a lot of stuff online. Like, here's an app. And it's really good for those people that are beginners and that have just basic questions and want to try their hand at maybe something small, like a little herb garden or something in their kitchen if you're in an apartment, you know, right through to those people that, you know, have or are lucky enough to have large pieces of land where they can grow bigger things and get a bit more adventurous.
It's very cool. And you know what? I think apps like this are going to continue to do so well because, you know, regardless of how things may be improving in certain areas of the world in terms of COVID-19, the pandemic, the truth is, I think more of us have had a chance to really get incredibly familiar with our homes. And there may be some people who, you know, continue to spend more time at home, especially if you're lucky enough to have an actual detached house with a yard. And this is a great example of how you can use an app to think more about plants and being part of a community as well. And I love this. You know, I aspire one day to do some gardening, and I see people on my street doing it. And I know Michael's going to laugh at me, but I imagine one day I would.
I really want to do it. Every time I talk to my parents, I want to save up, buy a house and where I can have a piece of earth, which that's a reference for anybody that's watched A Secret Garden. But it's really neat because if you do have more complex questions, you can actually book sessions and discuss them with what they call super peer experts. There's lots of workshops and sessions that you can attend. And as I said, even for beginners, there's like Plant Parents 101 groups is an example as well. So you're really all about collecting sharing the knowledge with everybody on the community.
It is super cool. Okay, so next up, Michael, this is a great one. We've actually been hearing a lot more about some of the negative things that happen within the film industry as well as the TV industry. And this is an app that can help to call out any bullying or abuse that takes place.
Yeah, this was, I stumbled upon it across a bunch of media outlets that were covering this. And it's called Call It, and it enables film and TV industry workers to report incidences of harassment, bullying, and abuse to executives or senior producers while they're on sets. And it can also be done, obviously, anonymously, because when you are dealing with harassment and bullying and abuse, a lot of the times people who were the ones that had this done to them can often feel ashamed and think they've done something wrong. And it's very difficult for them to come forward because they're also worried about being treated differently or being persecuted for bringing it forward. So I like the idea that there is an avenue for them to bring this to the attention of the right people in real time while they're working so it can be addressed.
Yeah, it's very cool. You know, it reminds me of an app I used to talk about in my speaking events a few years ago. It was very similar, and the idea was not in one specific industry, but it was in the workplace in general. And it was basically almost like an HR app that companies could use so individuals would have a chance to share, even if that meant anonymously, a situation that maybe was hurtful towards them. And it wasn't meant to be a place where you were just basically calling people out, but it was to give the HR managers a better sense of what was actually happening without individuals who maybe are uncomfortable revealing the full length to which they may be bullied or harassed in the workplace. Maybe they don't want to identify themselves. It was a really, really interesting app at the time. And I think it's good to see things happening in this space.
100%. And as I said, so the people in charge, they'll receive an anonymized top-level overview of what happened. And what is interesting about this app is it does store the data in a dashboard, but the reason why they do that is they allow executives to actually track the mood and the actual well-being of their workers on sets in real time. So they can have those regular daily talks when they say, you know, what we're doing and all that kind of stuff. They can also remind people in a friendly way, hey, this behavior isn't acceptable. Here are the protocols. Just remember that.
It's very cool. Speaking of something that's very cool, I know you're going to laugh at me because I do this all the time, but I'm downloading this on my phone right now as we talk.
You know what? I like it when it hasn't happened in a while, but I like it when you say, oh, I've downloaded this. But I think it's also because you're in one of the most beautiful parts of Canada where you are very lucky you can look up and see the most wondrous things.
Yeah, it's very cool. So basically the app is called Stellarium Plus, and it's a map for the stars. Now, where I am right now, I'm in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, but my family also has a place in Georgetown, which is kind of a tiny little community.
And which you've never invited me to. I know it's completely side note. We should bring this up another time. I just want it for the record. Go ahead.
Nothing to do with the travel restrictions and the fact that we've only owned it for
COVID, world pandemic. I don't remember any of that.
when you walk at night there, it always amazes me. And we've gone on many night walks, especially this summer, that it's pitch black. And so you can actually really get this beautiful view of the stars. And it's amazing to see an app like this that can help you be able to more closely identify the stars that you are looking at and create a map of the night sky. So I just downloaded this. I will try it tonight and it looks awesome. I downloaded a free version, but I think it's about $20 to buy the actual app if you want some of the added features. But according to this, it seems like it's probably worth even in paying that $20. I like that it's not even monthly from what I can tell, because you get to even track things like satellites, including the International Space Station. Lots of really cool features.
Well, it's definitely one to check out. So just again, those three apps that we mentioned, there's the Plant Life, we've got Colette, and Stellarium Plus, the star map. Of course, if you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, let us know. Tweet us at AmberMac and at AmBancroft80. And of course, use the hashtag TheFeed. Coming up, how a new Snapchat tool can help you run for office.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Power Friend.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, Snapchat is rolling out a new Run for Office in-app tool to encourage young adults to run for local office. To share more on the announcement, Kim Lyons is the deputy news editor of The Verge, and she's joining us now. Kim, is this a natural feature for the likes of Snapchat to be rolling out?
You know, it's interesting because Snapchat has been in this space for a minute. This is not the first time they've done something sort of civic-minded, voter education related. I think the company feels a sense of responsibility. They have a very young audience. They say that, you know, their audience reaches like 90% of 13 to 24-year-olds in the United States. And when you think about it, a lot of those users have not voted yet or may have voted for the first time in the 2020 elections. So I think they're feeling this sort of sense of, you know, this is an audience that has a need, has a desire to learn more, and maybe there's just not as much information available to them as they would like. So I think it's not necessarily the first thing you would think of when you think of Snapchat, but I do think it seems like a natural fit for them, sort of on some of the initiatives they've already started.
Let's talk a little bit about what a user would find within here, because I know on The Verge you have a bunch of screenshots and you've written an article about this. So it's quite comprehensive in terms of the different positions that may be available. So walk us through some of the features.
Yeah, it's actually really well thought out, I thought, you know, because a lot of times, you know, get out the vote efforts are very sort of, you know, performative. It's, hey, I voted, a sticker. It's kind of, you know, everyone has a feel good, you know, effect afterward, but there isn't much result to show for it. But this really was clearly thought through. So, you know, it's the understanding that these are people who have an interest in politics, maybe have interest in a specific issue, but they don't necessarily know where to start. So it starts you off, you know, when you go into the tool as a portal. It lets users find issues that are important to them. So things like civil rights, healthcare, education, immigration. And then when they sort of explore that aspect of it, then it sort of steers them next towards, you know, local elections in their area, like maybe a local school board election or maybe a local, you know, city council election, whatever the position might be that would be have a say in or have some kind of decision-making power over the issue that the person's already said that they're interested in. And so, you know, it helps, you know, sort of narrow down the field a little bit. So you see this school board, you know, position is open. I really care about education. It's something that's important to me. And then it gives, you know, some information about sort of deadlines you need to hit. You know, sometimes you have to gather signatures. When do you have to have the filing information? A lot of that stuff is not necessarily readily available elsewhere. And so what Snap has done is connected with, you know, candidate recruitment organizations. You know, the sort of, we've heard a lot about these. She Should Run is one example. So some of the organizations they partner with is Run for Something, New Politics, Run Gen Z, the LGBTQ Victory Institute. So they help sort of with the training resources to prepare them for a campaign, which, you know, it sounds like a good idea, but I think everyone knows that a campaign can be grueling and long. And when you don't have the right resources or access to information, it's a lot harder to kind of get your message out there. So it really sets potential candidates up for, here's what you'd be in for. Here's what the race is like. You know, these are the issues you care about. Kind of gives them this tool set to sort of get things launched, which I think is really the hardest part of any campaign. It's getting, you know, getting all your ducks in a row to make sure you have the information that you need, make sure your filing deadlines are met, and making sure you have all the requirements before you kind of jump into a full-fledged campaign.
And speaking of that connection aspect, they've gone, you know, one step further, it seems, and building on that community and positive community with features like nominate a friend, which I thought was very interesting, given when we look at other social media platforms, they're not doing as well from a positive community building perspective at the moment.
Right. I mean, Snap is very cognizant that a big part of their audience, a big appeal of their app is sharing information with friends. You know, that's sort of what Snapchat, how they started out. You can sort of nominate a friend. Now, this doesn't mean officially nominating someone, like collecting signatures. It's more of a nudge, you know, within the app. I nominate so-and-so, I think should be great on the school board, and kind of maybe persuade someone who's been thinking about it or make some, you know, reconsider it. I think there's something like people have to be asked 4 or 5 times to run for office before they actually do. So this is kind of in that vein, right? That suggesting it to someone that you think would be good, that maybe you know has interest in, you know, might be maybe looking for some confirmation that they're a good candidate, but it's definitely meant to, you know, have people engage with their friends on Snapchat. Would you be a good candidate for office? I think you would be. And maybe it gets the person kind of thinking about and exploring the, you know, the information that's in the app.
I was just thinking as you're talking that in light of what has taken place over the past few days or really weeks with Facebook and Instagram.
Why? Was something going on with Facebook?
You'll get to it soon.
Yeah.
It's really devastating in many ways. Those of us in the tech community have known about some of these issues, I think, for years now. But it strikes me that it is shining the spotlight further on these social platforms to be more responsible in nature, right? And I'm just curious how you see things shifting in terms of how social platforms have to be accountable for what they put out there in terms of features and their platform and the effects it has on society.
Right. So, I mean, right now we're all seeing kind of the effects of, or what's sort of been known for a while, right? The effects of Instagram, especially on teenage girls and their self-image. And that's something that obviously is being hotly debated at the moment. You know, what responsibility does the platform have to discourage this or change their app or modify it so that you're not contributing to this sort of culture of bullying online? So I think Snapchat certainly is not perfect in this regard. It's had some missteps here and there. They've launched some features that weren't that great. They've, you know, had some instances with their filters that were maybe not as sensitive as they could have been. But I do think they, knowing that their audience skews a bit younger than some of the other apps, I think they feel this sense of responsibility to make sure that they are providing a place that feels like a safe space, that feels there's going to be a positive contribution. It's not just, you know, it is exchanging fun things and fun filters and all of that. But in addition, it's a place where they can talk about serious issues, that they can feel like they can have these conversations. I do think it's a company that recognizes that it's accountable to this audience that really is very vulnerable in a lot of ways. They don't have a lot of world knowledge. They may be very, have good self-image. They may have, you know, a good structure around them at home. But, you know, once they sort of get out into the internet, it's sort of the Wild West in a lot of ways. So I do think Snap isn't a company that knows what its audience is, knows that it skews younger, and feels a sense of responsibility to make sure they are providing useful information as well as a fun place to sort of connect with friends.
Is it safe to say Snapchat seems to be making a conscious effort to grow up with its audience? So obviously, as you said, we know that they skew younger, but those younger users will eventually grow into older users. And these types of features, as you also mentioned, you know, they're not as fun as some of the other filters and other things that Snapchat Right. does. So it does seem like they're trying to ensure that once they do grow up, they still stay on Snapchat.
Yeah. And that, I think, is really the long game, right? Like, how do you keep the audience that helped you grow, that helped you become you know, a huge company, a huge platform. And I think it's interesting to consider that Snapchat is sort of growing up with its audience, that it's recognizing this is the audience that's been loyal to us. It's helped us become, you know, a household name. How do we then keep serving them content and serving them features that are beneficial to them, while at the same time, sort of looking behind them at, you know, their younger siblings or, you know, younger kids who are going to get on Snapchat? Maybe they don't, because I think what happens is sometimes with apps are kind of segmented by generation. You know, we sort of think of Facebook as sort of the baby boomer app. Maybe Twitter is like Gen X. I think Instagram is very squarely in the millennial Gen Z area. And then Snapchat's very much younger. So, you know, I think at the same time that companies have to think about growth, they always think that means, you know, attracting more users. Where do you find those users? And that's right. Been at the heart of the problems with Facebook recently, right, is that they have to keep growing. You're a public company. You have to show growth. And so how they've done it has been a little bit maybe badly handled. And I think Snapchat recognizes that they need to sort of stay in sync with their current audience, like you said, as they grow, as they become a voting age, but also make it a platform that if younger users want to come in, there's still a place for them. It's not just, you know, this one generation has defined what the app is about, which I think some other apps has sort of fallen into that, you know, whether intentionally or not, that they've served a certain audience for such a long time that it's hard to kind of branch out and attract newer audiences. But I think Snap is very cognizant growing the audience that they have currently, who helped them become a big company, and also potentially leaving the door open for younger users. I think this is an example of the kind of long game where you're sort of trying to serve both audiences potentially.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we thank you so much for spending time with us, and we want to encourage people to check out the Run for Office tool that you can read about more on theverge.com. And thanks so much for being here, Kim.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next, everything you need to know about the future of ethical AI.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the Spotlight.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, Encode Justice is an international group of grassroots activists pushing for ethical uses of artificial intelligence. Its founder and president, Sneha Ravanur, is joining us now to discuss how the group is helping educate people on the dangers of artificial intelligence-based applications. It's quite a difficult task for sure. Maybe let's start with how you got started and brought this activist group together. What was the reason behind you wanting to do this?
I think that as for the story of Encode Justice, about 2 years ago, I came across an investigation into a tool called Compass, which is a risk assessment tool used widely by jurisdictions across the US in pretrial decisions. And what this investigation found was that Black defendants were actually twice as likely to be falsely flagged as high risk and as future criminal offenders than white defendants were. So the error rate for Black defendants was twice as high than it was for white defendants. And I think seeing that staggering disparity made me realize that technology is not objective and neutral. Technology actually has the ability to carry forward the same discrimination, the same biases that have already been baked into our society and into our systems for decades and centuries. And so I think realizing that, and then seeing last summer that California was considering a ballot measure that would mandate the use of the exact same algorithms statewide, I think seeing the opposition and disarray caused me to leap into action. We immediately began to recruit volunteers, call voters, host phone banks and events, host town halls and panels, and write op-eds. And I think at one point, hashtag no on Prop 25, Prop 25 is the name of the ballot measure, was actually, I think, trending number one statewide on Twitter. So we were actually able to gain a lot of traction from that initial effort to battle Prop 25. And Our victory came to fruition. We actually won with a 12.8% margin, and that was a very energizing victory for us. And I think at that point, I had a bit of awakening because I realized that this issue transcends California. It transcends a single ballot measure, and it transcends just the criminal justice system, because algorithms are increasingly being used to guide high-stakes decisions across every single sector and every single industry, from healthcare to hiring to policing to lending to housing and much more. And I think that it has left and it has reinforced discrimination in each and every single one of those avenues. And at that point, we realized that it was a 21st century civil rights challenge that we were going to have to grapple with, and that we realized that there was no place for young people yet in that movement. We had to carve out our own niche. And so we founded ENCODE Justice. And I think since then, I've presided over its expansion as founder and president. And that initial team of about 10, 15 students from my school district and the next couple of school districts has now blossomed into an international army of over 250 youth. So I think seeing that expansion has been absolutely surreal. And I think seeing our ability to, you know, to operate all of these, you know, concurrent initiatives, because we're currently fighting for a ban on the government use of facial recognition technology. We are currently fighting the use of deepfakes and their ability to spread misinformation. I think seeing all of these concurrent initiatives has really awakened me to the potential of youth organizing, and I think really the role that we have to play in the broader algorithmic justice movement. So I think in terms of how we got started, it really did all start with that investigation that I came across, and it really did all start with that single campaign for Prop 25 and against Prop 25, and how that really catapulted us into this entire, you know, initiative of really fighting for algorithmic justice, and I think mobilizing youth to advance that cause.
So one question for you in terms of something you said in a CNN article. You said, mm-hmm. We're fighting for a future in which technology can be used to uplift and not to oppress. So for the average person out there who maybe doesn't have your level of expertise around the impact of AI and algorithms as well, how do you see us being able to kind of shape this future? And can an individual play a role in this?
Yes, absolutely. I think that all of us have a role to play in shaping that future. So I think in order for me to speak about shaping the future, I have to sort of talk more about the landscape of what things look like right now. And I think that there are some very compelling examples that I can use to, you know, lay out that case. So for example, right now with police use of something called facial recognition technology, we've actually seen 3 wrongful arrests due to software error because these algorithms are less likely to be trained on darker skinned faces and therefore less likely to be accurate on darker skinned faces when used for real-time classification and real-time identification. And so we've seen how pretty much all the leading, you know, commercial algorithms used and produced by facial recognition companies and then sold to law enforcement agencies actually carry pretty deeply entrenched racial biases because of their inability to perform on certain groups. And so that's one example of a technology that has sort of reinforced discrimination worldwide. We've also seen, for example, how the recruiting tool recently used by Amazon, it came under fire for the fact that a hiring algorithm was using actually discriminated against female applicants and was able to pick up on words and resumes that actually signaled that an applicant was female or an applicant identified as a female without actually having any additional context, even without the variable of gender being explicitly factored into the algorithm. So we've seen how those sorts of things have taken place. And if we really hope to shape a more equitable future in which technology can be used to uplift and not to oppress, as I said, we need strong federal data privacy safeguards, and we need that in every single government worldwide. We need to regulate the use of these sorts of terrifying manifestations of artificial intelligence, whether that be facial recognition or deepfakes. And we also need at the national level for every single country, we need to make sure that there are bureaucratic agencies tasked with ensuring that commercial algorithms are able to meet certain metrics for equity, are able to meet certain metrics for fairness, and are able to ensure that before these algorithms are, you know, put into use, there is a certain standard of, you know, proven fairness that it's been able to achieve. And I think that we don't currently have that robust regulation yet. So some have proposed, for example, in the US, creating an agency very similar to the FDA to regulate algorithms and to ensure that algorithms and, you know, commercial developers of algorithms are held accountable to certain standards and safeguards that have been put in place. And so I think that
absolutely
in the future, we have to definitely establish agencies like that in different governments and to ensure that there is, you know, broad multinational and multilateral cooperation to address the issue of artificial intelligence, because it's obviously becoming an issue that has bled into the spheres of national security and human rights and such. And when it comes to the role of the individual in fighting for this future, I think that we really have to first dismantle this notion in our head that technology is perfectly scientific and neutral. I think that we all have at some point bought into that myth of algorithmic neutrality. And I think that that blind trust in these systems has truly sort of, you know, allowed us to, you know, sort of pivot to a future where algorithms are making decisions left and right, and there really are no checks and balances on that. And so I think we have to first, as individuals, really target that notion. I think we also have to look to how we can action in our own community. So those are some of the ways that I can see individual contributions playing out.
Well, listen, we want to encourage people to check out Encode Justice. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. When we come back, we share a cybersecurity tip for better passwords.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now, and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
Before we get to Socially Speaking, this cybersecurity tip is powered by Norton. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So let's talk about getting cyber smart with good cyber hygiene. What exactly is cyber hygiene? Well, you can think of it about it as a cybersecurity version of washing your hands well with soap for 20 seconds, something we've all been doing over the past year and a half and hopefully longer. Cyber hygiene is a set of basic habits that can help to keep you and your family's devices protected from identity theft, scams, and other online dangers. Now, examples of practicing good cyber hygiene include using strong passwords, setting up multi-factor authentication on your accounts, and regularly updating software on your devices. This is something I have to remind my boys about all the time. When it comes to strong passwords, I use a passphrase that is unique to me. This is a sentence that should be at least 12 characters long. Along with a passphrase, I also use two-factor authentication. This is really a second layer of protection, and it adds an extra step between inputting your password and accessing your account, which is so critical in today's times. Now, speaking of protection, no one can prevent all cybercrime or identity theft, but Norton 360 is what I trust to help protect my devices and my family's devices against cyber threats. For more information, you can visit Staples in-store or online. Now we're going to get to our socially speaking topic. And unsurprisingly, we're going to dive into what we talked about off the top of the show and really the impact that this news has had on Facebook in terms of the company in general. Now, Michael and Aaron, this probably won't surprise you, but during the outage on Monday, the company lost about $60 million. But even more significant is that Mark Zuckerberg's total wealth actually decreased about $6 billion US, and that's a billion with a B. He is worth a lot of money. That's sort of just a tiny little drop in the bucket. But Michael, it's still significant in the sense that finally, I think we're seeing sort of the sunlight shine through the cracks when we think about Facebook as a social network that at one point felt as though maybe they were just too big to fail.
I agree and I disagree, because again, if you look at the stock, it's trading at $330 or so the last time I checked, and it only fell from 300 the height it's been in the last, I think, year was like 384. So I don't know if this is enough to hurt it long term, because obviously this is a reaction maybe to the news and this, but will it continue to have an impact? I don't think so. Unless we see the government step in and we see movement in regards to regulation and we see Facebook being forced to change, you know, their actual protocols internally. And maybe this is the catalyst for other people to step forward. I don't know. Then if that happens, then maybe sure. Because again, this isn't new news. I guess the difference here is that we now have somebody with credible proof internally that they knew and then maybe made decisions regardless of what they knew. So maybe that's probably the difference here. So maybe that could long-term have an effect if people take action?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, I got asked this question on a national TV show I did this week. And they asked me, are people going to leave Facebook? So, Aaron, maybe I'll throw that to you, because I think we keep putting the pressure on individuals in terms of the ones taking action. But this is just bigger than any one person. What would you say to that?
Yeah, and I think the outage the other day showed us the true colors, that even if people do leave Facebook, because Instagram and WhatsApp are under the same umbrella in a technological sense, it appears, and also in a corporate sense, obviously, that even if you do leave Facebook, a lot of people are dependent on these other apps for other reasons, and WhatsApp may be huger outside of North America than some North Americans may realize, that it's hard to get away from them. And I'm Michael touched on it a bit. I wonder if regulation or breaking up the company or breaking it down might help. But then I'm also dismayed by recently there was a hearing in the U.S. and I'm dismayed by some lawmakers that might be tasked with that job that don't understand what the job is ahead of them. And I'm thinking of a recent clip of a U.S. lawmaker speaking to someone representing Facebook or was it Instagram, asking them to shut down Finsta and harping on that one point that you must shut down Finsta. Well, Finsta is shorthand for fake Instagram accounts for people that have more than one. Not everyone does. And this lawmaker has obviously passed this word on a piece of paper and told to drill down on that point, but didn't know what the point was. So if breaking up the company helps, will the people tasked with doing that know how to do it correctly in order to help the citizens slash consumers?
It's a really good point. And I mean, I actually see such a huge gap here all the time between what governments understand about how technology works and how they have the ability to be able to introduce any type of regulation, because there is definitely a gap there. Michael, some final thoughts from you in terms of the impact this will have on Facebook long term. Do you think that it's going to make a difference in terms of the past few weeks as far as these exposés and whistleblower?
I mean, I don't think so in the short term. It will only make a difference in the long term if more people come forward and actual change is demanded and enforced, which is two different things. So demand is one thing, but actually following through and holding them accountable is another. In fairness, as I said off the top of the show, I didn't notice Facebook was out. I mean, and Instagram. The only reason I knew there was something wrong was because I use WhatsApp for communicating to somebody who is much older than me, because that's the way they use the technology. It would be different if it was LinkedIn or Twitter. Then I would have probably been like, oh, but again, like I just went to normal email. I don't think it's as big a deal as people think, because there's so many platforms and the younger audience is so nimble. They'll just go and pick one of the other platforms they're on to communicate with their friends. I kind of liken Facebook to cable news. I think, I mean, the audience is much older. I think that eventually once they kind of disappear, Facebook will kind of eventually lose its value and prominence, I guess. I mean, I don't see it lasting forever, but maybe it'll just slowly wind down like we've seen cable news.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And they own so much, you know, they also own Instagram and WhatsApp. So, you know, it's going to be a fascinating few months. Let us know what you think. You can find us online at Amber Mack and at MBancroft80. And please use the hashtag The Feed.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks, Channel 167.